Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The NAACP will open their 116th National Convention here in Charlotte. Founded in the early 20th century, the organization has played a pivotal role in shaping civil rights. It was the NAACP's legal team that steered the Brown v. Board of Education case through the Supreme Court, ending racial segregation in public schools. They've worked to ensure voting rights and to increase black voter participation. They've also helped organize the March on Washington back in 1963. It was at that march that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. coined the phrase, "the fierce urgency of now," as he spoke from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial.
"We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy."
It is the belief of the NAACP's convention organizers that the fierce urgency of now has resurfaced. In fact, that is the theme of the convention, one in which, for the first time in the organization's history, they have not invited the sitting president to appear. They believe Donald Trump's goals are in opposition to theirs. They work to advance civil rights. They view Trump as working to eliminate them. This hour, we look ahead to that convention in Charlotte, at the decision not to invite Trump, at the mission of the NAACP, and at its continued relevance, and more. We're joined by Dr. James E. Ford, Executive Director of the Center for Racial Equality and Education, CREED for short. Glenn Berkins is founder and publisher of Q-City Metro, and Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Good morning, everybody. Welcome.
Good morning.
So, James, let me start with you. When Dr. King spoke back in 1963 of the fierce urgency of now, he was speaking at the culmination of a march to demand civil rights legislation, to demand desegregation, to demand an end to police brutality, a beginning to minimum wage increases and fair labor standards, and the protections of the right to vote. Some believe that all of those things are under attack again today. The NAACP certainly believe so. So should we be surprised by this turn of events, that the same fights that were being fought in the 60s are being fought again today?
Yeah, I don't know if we should be surprised, but we certainly shouldn't be encouraged by that. I think it means that we haven't progressed as far as we oftentimes believe that we have, to still be fighting for many of the same things, using some of the same language, almost 70 years later. I think just we oftentimes pat ourselves on the back with how far we've come. And, you know, in terms of the sense of urgency, I'm struck by the words, the tranquilizing drug of gradualism, because that's what we've been sold, is that, you know, by and by, just hang in there, things will change, the tide will start to turn. And what we're finding is much like notions of trickle-down economics, trickle-down justice also has proven not to be a very effective strategy. So you have to change. You have to change your approach. And so ramping things up, increasing the energy, especially in this environment, requires us to be a lot more aggressive. And so I appreciate the call and the response from the NAACP to re-energize ourselves and to activate our efforts to really make sure that we respond to the moment.
Mary, the civil rights movement in the 60s had a significant number of leaders, the king of which was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He was the preeminent civil rights leader of his time. Do these times and the efforts to maintain the rights previously gained need or even have right now a champion like Dr. King, or will this effort to prevent backsliding have to take a different approach?
Well, though King was folks would say leader, he was the most visible person. Of course, he was charismatic in the way he spoke. You cannot forget that there were many, many people in many, many organizations all around the country and even the world who were a part of that movement. Of course, then you didn't see all the amount of women who were a part of it that were in those audiences when King spoke, and groups who were really, you know, the Medgar Evers, you know, Dorothy Hyde, so many others who were doing so many things in my home state of Maryland, Gloria Richardson, people you might not have heard of, but who were just doing important work. So I think the search for one leader is really just something that it's mistaken. And I do think that movements take different forms at all times. And what you said before, should we be surprised? Of course we shouldn't. As my son, who is an historian, will remind me, with progress always comes pushback, and it has happened. Reconstruction was followed by Jim Crow. Many folks would say that the election of Barack Obama was a shock to some people. Some people thought it was great progress. For other folks, they thought, this isn't my country. And some people would say that his two terms gave us Donald Trump as sort of a rebuke to the progress that had been made. So many Americans see progress as zero sum. If someone gets ahead and shares in the bounty of America and shares in the ideals that made us America, that somebody else loses. So, you know, to answer your original question about one leader, of course, charismatic leaders come and go, but I think that it's really a movement that takes everyone on the ground, a grassroots movement, which was what happened with the civil rights movement. And you will see different folks come, and it would be great, you know, Obama really got a lot of young people interested, a lot of people, young people involved, and maybe that's what it takes. But I would say it's more grassroots, and to say it needs one leader would be to really minimize the importance of all the folks that'll be here for the convention. They're in their communities doing hard work.
Glenn Berkins is with us. He's the founder and publisher of Q City Metro, and I mentioned that because he's in touch with reporters who cover the community and with the people who are members of that community. And as you hear from your reporters and as you talk to people in Charlotte, are they expressing any concerns about moves to suppress the vote, to curtail advances in holding law enforcement officials accountable, in efforts in Washington to slow down and or reverse advances in equality through the elimination of DEI programs, or in the way we teach American history? Is that at all even top of mind, or are they busy going about their daily lives?
There's no question that they are talking about it, and that it's top of mind. I think we need to make a couple points. First, I think we have to recognize that this is not 1950s. This is not 1960s. There are no water cannons. There are no dogs. What we're seeing now, I believe, it's much less about visceral hatred of or racial hatred as much as raw political power. We're seeing these same attacks not just on Black people. We're seeing these same attacks on women. We're seeing these same attacks on LGBTQ. We're seeing these same attacks on students at Ivy League schools. So I think the first thing we have to recognize is that the attacks have changed, and therefore the strategies must change. Getting back to your question, Mike, are we seeing the type of organizing that we saw in the 1950s and 60s? No, we're not seeing that. And I think we're not seeing that for the reasons that I mentioned. It's very easy to organize when your people are being lynched, when dogs are being set upon people who just simply want to register to vote. They're not doing those things now. It's much more about voter suppression. It's much more about removing precincts from or voting booths from certain parts of Black and brown communities. So yes, it is definitely top of mind. But it looks a lot different than it looked in the 1950s and 60s.
It's more insidious. It's kind of hidden if you're not watching. And it's happening slowly in very many different places over time. That maybe you don't know it because it didn't happen. You don't live in North Carolina, or you don't live in Georgia, or you don't live in some other community where these things are taking place. James, 116 years is a long time for any organization to exist, and that's how long the NAACP has been around. Talk about their efforts over time and what they've accomplished.
Yeah, I think a lot of people tend to think about civil rights as just happening in the 1960s. And the truth is the civil rights era spans over 100 years. The NAACP emerges out of the Niagara Movement, which was started by W.E.B. Du Bois, renowned sociologist and thinker, and my fraternity brother. And, it, you know, even in those times, coming out of Reconstruction, there was efforts to enfranchise Black people, to give them political capital and power. And out of that, you know, that kind of petered out in the early 1900s. But out of that emerged what became the NAACP, which was a cross-racial coalition of people, Black folks and progressive white folks who came together to create an institution in an effort to ensure the seizing of those rights and those opportunities. So over the years, of course, voting rights, the dismantling of segregation and access to education have all been, you know, just a few of the campaigns that the NAACP has championed and won a lot of victories throughout the years. And so I think that it is the seminal civil rights organization in the United States. I think it's been a template for folks internationally. In all fairness, I think in the last maybe 20 to 30 years, you know, our generation, I'll say, like, you know, Gen Xers and millennials, we don't have the same lore around the NAACP, right? So a lot of the movements to the uprisings in the past few years, like such as Black Lives Matter, we don't see them as prominently as the leaders of those movements. And so the appreciation for the history, I think, is there and should be there. But also this kind of a what have you done for me or what have you done for us lately? And so this positioning of themselves to respond to the moment, I think, really does allow the younger generation to find a place and find a way to position themselves within the next wave of the movement, which I do think requires new visions and new strategies and a more
relevance.
Radical.
Relevance was going to be my next question, Mary, because when the NAACP was founded in 1909, it was a very different world. It was only 44 years away from the abolition of slavery. Jim Crow was in full bloom, and one would say would only get worse over the first half of the 20th century. There's no question that the NAACP was a necessary organization for advancing rights and improving the lives of people, Black Americans in particular, but they have worked for people other than Black Americans over their history. But is their role as vital and important today at a time when a lot of these protests are organic? They are leaderless.
Well, I would say yes. James talked about the legacy of the NAACP. When you talked earlier about erasing history, a part of that is folks not knowing how many things that we owe to the NAACP and the giants that work with them. Folks like Thurgood Marshall, Sherrilyn Ifill, from Charlotte, North Carolina, Julius Chambers, who was the head of the Legal Defense Fund. And, you know, I am living in Myers Park in a house that I could not have lived in, my parents could not have lived in, because of restricted covenants in the deeds until the Fair Housing Act of 1968, which made those illegal. So I think part of it is knowing how relevant they have been and how they still are doing this. Folks like Rosa Parks, who didn't just sit on a bus and she was tired, you know, she was an activist who would go through the South and, you know, interview folks when there was an injustice, when there were problems.
I know that Glenn wants to get in on this, but Glenn will have to do it after the break because we're coming up to that right now. And I want to also ask you about something that James alluded to, and that is reinvigorating young people and making them understand what the NAACP has done and what they can do going forward if they get involved with it. And we'll do that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking in advance of the NAACP convention, their 116th convention coming to town and opening on Saturday at the Charlotte Convention Center with Dr. James Ford, Executive Director of CREE, the Center for Racial Equity and Education. Glenn Berkins is here, who a founder and publisher of QCity Metro, and Mary C. Curtis, a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Just prior to the break, we were talking about the role of the NAACP today, and is it as vital and as important, and can it be, as it was during much of its 116-year history? I know Glenn wants to talk about this, but Mary, you wanted to finish your point before the break.
Oh, and just say, if to see how relevant it is, John Roberts, who is now the Chief Justice, overseeing some of these cases, rolling back things like voting rights, he was a young law student working against the Voting Rights Act. And so this is a fight that continues. So it's as relevant as ever. And when I was looking at the program of the convention, so much of the programs are for innovation, for young people, offering things to make it relevant to them, talking about dealing with AI and how this has a social justice component. So the organization itself seems to be looking ahead, saying, how can we stay relevant to young people today?
Glenn.
I would agree with Mary. I think the organization is absolutely relevant. But even there, I think we have to put that into a broader and more historical context. I can't remember when, but there was a book, I think, called Bowling Alone, which talked about how institutions in general, people are just not connected with institutions, period, like they used to be. So I think, the NAACP's efforts and its challenges in connecting with this generation is no different than the Masons or this or the Sierra Club or what any other organizations now. Younger people are just a little bit more reluctant than our parents were to align themselves with official organizations. I think, Mike, it was you who mentioned many of the protests now are organic. Many of the movements now bubble up from the ground. The internet, social media has made all of that possible. And we're seeing that not just in the United States, we're seeing it in other countries too.
Can these organic movements, James, be as effective as movements that had leaders, identifiable leaders who guided and shaped whatever movements they were involved in? Because these organic movements can border on anarchy, it seems to me, if they don't have any focus to them.
Yeah, well, I think that they can. And in ways, I think they can actually be more effective, because I think one of the flaws of those movements of the past historically is that once those leaders are compromised or assassinated, some of the energy dissipates, right? And so when we focus too much on the individual and there's not more of a distributive leadership model, I think they're easier to capture. And so I think what young people have figured out, either from historical memory or just from adaptation, is that things are actually better when it's more democratic, right? When there are people who, there's not one single charismatic leader. I think those models are outdated. Charisma still has currency and all those things, but you know, with the internet, with so much access to information, with the ability to publish ideas from all across the globe, all over the world, very, very quickly, and to self-educate ourselves, I think that those models are sort of antiquated. And so a lot of this is more of a decentralized approach, which I think makes it actually more nimble, more elusive, and as I said, at its heart, more democratic, which I think is a good thing.
So the convention, the NAACP convention, which opens on Saturday, is here in Charlotte, but it's not here in Charlotte for the very first time. It's been held here in the past, I think 1996, Glenn, was the first time or the last time it was here. And it moves around the country. Last year, about 23,000 people attended that convention in Las Vegas. I think Las Vegas has more to draw people in than perhaps Charlotte does. So we'll see how many people end up coming here. But is there a particular reason that you know of why Charlotte was chosen this time, or is it just luck of the draw?
Well, Charlotte was on the map to host the convention. I believe it was back in 2000, or was it 20? Yeah, somewhere around then. It was postponed because of the pandemic.
COVID, yeah.
And so now it's coming back to Charlotte. If you talk to Charlotte leaders, you would say that Charlotte itself has a lot to do with had a lot to do with its election then and a lot to do with its election now, in terms of our infrastructure, in terms of our compact downtown, and frankly, in terms of our leadership. Charlotte is unique among many cities in that it has a number of Black leaders in key positions, from police chief all the way up to mayor to the district attorney and so forth. So
I would
I
argue,
think that there are.
James, I mean, Glenn, I would argue they're all African American.
Well, I might not argue with you there. I wouldn't say all, but certainly a majority.
Including the new city manager.
Yes, the county, the new county
County
manager.
manager,
Yeah.
county manager. I'm sorry,
So,
county manager.
at one point, it was estimated about 15,000 people would attend this convention from all across the country here in Charlotte, beginning on Saturday. The NAACP Charlotte-Mecklenburg chapter president, who happens to be Corinne Mack, has said this convention isn't just for delegates; it's for our entire community. Mary, does that mean you don't have to be a delegate to attend, or was she referring to the fact that they're having something called the Hub, which is a career summit combination college fair combination block party with music combination area to meet and talk with Black business owners, which is open to the public. But is the whole convention? Or do you
I think
know?
you have to be a delegate to come to some of the meetings and workshops, which they have quite a few on everything from storytelling, the LGBTQ forum, history, AI. But they do have this public area, and I do think they've really worked with leaders in the city and the business leaders to showcase Black businesses. I do also think, as we've all been discussing, they want to get excitement around the idea of the NAACP again, let folks know what it's doing, have young people come and go, come and see what they can find to work with perhaps the NAACP. So I think it's perhaps that the main the hub that gathering for everyone. And I also think that the restaurants, hotels, and all of the organizations downtown are really looking forward to it. It's a slow season, the summer, and they really want everybody to mix and mingle and come and find out what Charlotte is about. And so I do think, yeah, there will be. They're inviting folks to come in and open more so than many conventions that just have their own delegates there.
If you go to their website, the NAACP website, there are several areas where they prominently feature photographs of young people being involved. So clearly they know that young people are the future. Without young people coming in, that's the end of the organization. That's the end of any organization. But do young people feel this affinity, James? And what do they have to do to make them feel this affinity? Do they have to allow them into leadership positions almost from the get-go so that they can help guide this organization to a point where they can attract other younger people more quickly?
Well, first, I would like to just declare that despite how I look, I'm actually no longer young. So I'm not totally on how young people feel. I just want to state that. But in my opinion, I would say, respectfully, no. I mean, I think a lot of young people aren't feeling connected for any host of reasons, not necessarily failures of the NAACP, but just the changing nature of how information and energy is shared and distributed. And so the question regarding do you have to engage, you absolutely have to. You just have to, because every movement of every generation has been led by young people. It's a hack that most of us don't really realize. They have more energy and they have less to lose, and they're more idealistic, and they'll put it on the line. A lot of us have gotten older and have a lot of other concerns which moderate us. We're gonna we but the NAACP is wise to feature young people prominently, to create the scheduling and programming around them, because you simply not only can't sustain your stuff, I don't think you could be relevant or impactful without the ideas, energy, and investment from young people. So to throw everything at that demographic is wise, particularly at this moment.
And they have a
We
lot to
have.
learn from young people. They have, as you said, social media. They can get an or a group together in minutes. An affinity group. They have a lot to bring, a lot of gifts, and so it's the only way they can remain nimble is to use that energy, use those gifts.
So we're about 25 minutes into this conversation, and we must now address the elephant not in the room. And that would be the lack of an invitation to the sitting president to attend this convention. Leon Russell, the chair of the NAACP National Board of Directors, has said what is happening in the Trump administration and in some Republican-controlled states is a, quote, coordinated attack on civil rights, from voter suppression to censorship in classrooms to economic exclusion. And because they believe that Donald Trump is working at cross purposes with the NAACP, they chose not to invite him. And here's how NAACP President Derek Johnson explained it to CBS News.
We invited him as candidate Trump in 2016. We invited him all 4 years when he was in office. He was invited in 2020 when he was back candidate Trump. And he has yet to ever accept the invitation. But this time, it's like, you know, not only are we not going to waste the invitation, we don't want him on our stage because what he has done in the past, and he does not respect the Constitution. We embrace the Constitution, and we would not invite anyone on our stage who simply cannot agree on the guardrails of a constitutional democracy, and that's something we don't see him respecting.
But James, would it not be smart to invite him, hope that he would come, and then bend his ear, have a conversation with him about the perceived impact of his policies and his proposed policies, especially since it's becoming apparent that Donald Trump listens to the last person who spoke to him?
Honestly, no. I think it's a waste of time. And I think the time for decorum is over. I think President did a good job narrating all the other extensions of olive branches and how they were ignored in the past. And I feel like we exhaust sometimes the method of civility, almost to try to provide ourselves cover to say, hey, we did the most that we could. But let's be frank and let's be honest about what's happening here, right? We are headlong in a surge of fascism. And so the notion of providing cover or appealing to public perceptions about, you know, how much we try to accommodate somebody, we're past that point now. You know, these gentlemen and gentlewomen's agreements and all this stuff, I think we got to get to a point where verifiably and objectively, this guy is, you know, however you feel about his policies, doesn't really care a lot about, you know, mores and customs. That's why a lot of people like him. So why accommodate that? What are you gaining in the process of it? I think people, we collectively, but certainly in NAACP, just needs to go forward with their goals, what they're trying to achieve, and target that towards power. But trying to persuade someone who's proven over and over again not to be not to enter these conversations in good faith, I think is a waste of time.
Glenn,
as a journalist, I respect the organization's right to invite whomever they choose. I would point out, however, and Mary, you can join me here. We saw what happened when candidate Trump was invited to the last National Association of Black Journalists convention. There was a lot of dissension and disagreement in terms of whether he should have been invited. It did not go well. It ended up being a hostile encounter. He ended up leaving the stage early. So I think organizations may look at that and make their own decisions about whether it is a good idea to invite the president under the guise of engagement.
Mary, I want to get your take on this, but I want to put this into some perspective here. Harry Truman was the first sitting president to attend the NAACP convention. That was back in 1947. Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, and George H.W. Bush, to the best of my knowledge, did not attend, nor did Trump during his first term, although he was asked on several occasions. George W. Bush turned down several invitations to speak until he finally did accept. But all other modern presidents, if you can figure out who they are, did accept the invitation. Ronald Reagan even accepted the invitation, and although he got a semi-cool reception, he used that occasion to decry white supremacy. But this is the first time that a president has not been invited. What's your take, Mary, on that decision?
Well, I do think George H.W. did come once. I can check on that, but I do believe. Okay. And Dwight Eisenhower. I go with what Glenn was saying, that this president does have a track record of insulting and lecturing majority Black organizations like the National Association of Black Journalists. We saw what happened when the South African president visited the White House. He lectured him, insulted him, showed him a slideshow. And he has described majority Black cities like Baltimore, the one I grew up in, as dystopian hellholes where no human beings are fit to live. And we saw his message around the time of the 4th of July when he used it to say, insult and in people who voted against the mega bill, tax and spend bill, saying he hates Democrats, he can't stand them, and he thinks they hate America. So I do believe that they had, you know, their own, what they wanted to accomplish, the NAACP, and they certainly have the right to do that and make a statement while doing that, which they did.
Glenn, in 2016, 6% of Black voters supported candidate Trump. In 2020, 8% supported him for re-election. In 2024, that number rose to 15% of Black voters supporting him. That's a doubling of support in a very short amount of time. But the NAACP is turning their backs on him. Are they ignoring a growing number of the people they claim to fight and represent, fight for and represent?
I would not. I'm not sure I would quite go that far. This last election was an election for the books. And I think this election turned out the way it turned out for any number of reasons. I don't think there was any one thing that we can point to and say that is the reason why more Black voters voted for Trump, or that is the reason why more this group or that group. I think the NAACP has to represent its mission. And its mission is to protect, defend, and promote civil and human rights, economic advancement for Black people in particular, and people of color. And so I don't think it should become an organization that necessarily looks at the latest poll. Polls come and go. But your mission, your reason for being, should be consistent. And I think that's what we're seeing.
And as you say, they have a particular mission that seems to be at odds with the Trump administration just on paper, but they are also taking action against the Trump administration in several areas right now. And it might be odd to have the sitting president, against whom they are involved in several lawsuits over policies, to be there. We'll talk about that and more when we come back with Glenn Berkins, the founder and publisher of Q City Metro, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast, and Dr. James Ford, executive director of the Center for Racial Equity in Education. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the NAACP convention, their 116th anniversary convention, which opens in Charlotte and runs for several days, 4 days, I believe, beginning on Saturday. It's a convention to which they have not invited, for the very first time in their history, the sitting president of the United States. And Stephen A. Smith, an outspoken commentator on sports and culture and politics, has asked, if you don't invite Trump and you ostracize and ignore him, how does that advance anything that the NAACP is trying to accomplish? I'm not sure who to ask this question of, so I'll just ask, do any of you have an answer to that question, or do you think he's out of touch?
I think it's a false premise. It assumes that engaging him would advance anything as well. And so I guess I disagree with the premise of it. As I said, I think there's a time where you have to weigh the pros and cons and determine whether engaging with someone who's proven over and over again to do so in bad faith nets you anything. I think, you know, he is the executor, right? And so there are ways you can still target, you know, legislators and different branches of government to advance your agenda at different levels of, you know, local, you know, state and federal level interventions. But the idea that you must engage the president, you know, in order to make any sort of progress, I just think is a false premise.
So, and I might be more inclined to agree with him if President Trump had gone in the past and shown himself to be willing to engage. But that's not the case. He has not gone in the past. We don't even know if he would have gone had he been invited. I think it's a false premise.
And if he had gone, it would have been about himself. We know that he is always trying to grab the news cycle, grab the headline, maybe to distract from other things he doesn't want to talk about. So you can almost predict that if he had gone, it would have been the Trump show. And NAACP has a lot of things on the agenda, and I think they're taking them seriously.
And the president of that organization has alluded to that when he gets the speaker's platform, he goes off on these tangents that have nothing to do with why he was invited to be there. And that's not, that seems to be a habit at every appearance, not just of certain appearances, all appearances. Trump is not the first president to be at odds with the NAACP and some of their initiatives, but still those other presidents were invited. Many came, but this is a particular snub, and James just kind of alluded to this, that maybe focuses on just how abnormal the Trump presidency is in the scheme of American presidencies. A, would you agree with that, Mary? And B, is the NAACP like a canary in a coal mine of canaries, merely adding their voice to what is becoming readily apparent to most people, or is their voice a particularly loud one?
Well, I do think Jamelle Bouie had a really interesting column in the New York Times that, as much as folks like to say that Donald Trump is a maverick in many ways, it is the Republican agenda, you know, since the New Deal, trying to make that go away, being against, when they came up, Social Security and Medicare and all of these programs, cutting back on voting rights, cutting taxes for rich folks. So in some ways, it's the same agenda. But of course, he is really a singular figure in that many folks are drawn to him, even when his policies and the policies that he promotes really hurt them. As we can see, many people are going to lose their health care with this latest bill, including many poor folks who voted for him. What I have been surprised at is how quickly that other branches of government have given up their co-equal power, the way Congress is not standing in its power, but they're basically saying, yes, we want to go along with everything this president says. We're afraid that he'll primary us or say a bad word against us. And the way the Supreme Court, and remember, Donald Trump in his first term appointed three members of that court, are going along with so many things on the shadow docket, saying, well, we won't rule on whether you can send undocumented immigrants to a third country, but you can do it while we figure this out. And so in that case, I do think that he is different in that way. He's getting his way. And now we just now see where he has accused the Justice Department in the past of weaponization, but he indeed is going after his perceived enemies as he said he would. So in that way, the NAACP, yes, is a leader in calling this out. And I would say trying to do something about it, in that, you know, they always have been an organization that have brought lawsuits, that have had actions that have supported causes. So yes, he is different in some ways, though his agenda is an old one, which is moving back things. So, but yes, the NAACP is calling it out, and so perhaps, Glenn, hoping others will go along.
Glenn, yeah. That's among why, when she talks about calling it out, the NAACP has called moves by the Trump administration unconstitutional, un-American, and the fact that he's making moves that undermine every pillar of our democracy. But the New York Times quotes White House spokesman Harrison Fields as saying, as a result of this snub, the NAACP isn't advancing anything but hate and division while the president is focusing on uniting our country. Is that just another example of where we are and how each side views the other? Doesn't that call for dialogue in order to find the reality and some middle ground? Because clearly one side is living in bizarro land and the other is not.
Well, I would point out, Mike, that what we're seeing here is really a small example of what we're seeing globally to some degree. I think on a global scale, countries and leaders are starting to question America's leadership. especially under this administration. Because we have the world's largest economy and the world's most powerful military, it's hard for them to decouple. But what the NAACP is doing, I think we're seeing happen on a global scale to some degree. No, nations are not snubbing Trump because, as I mentioned, we have the world's largest economy. We have the power of the purse. We have the currency that that is most important in the around the world. So I think they have to give certain deference. But I think a lot of world powers, a lot of organizations, are now starting to question. You know, is this a government that stands for the things that we believe in? Is this a government that stands for the things that we fought for and went to war for? And so, you know, I won't comment on the comments of the White House official. I'll let him have his say on that. But there is an assumption built into that statement that honest dialogue is possible with this administration. And I think that might be a false premise.
James, we've talked about how some of the initiatives of the Trump administration are at odds with the mission of the NAACP. And I mentioned before the break that the NAACP is pushing back. Their legal defense fund is suing the Trump administration. Six lawsuits have been filed. One is a challenge in the U.S. Department to the U.S. Department of Education's elimination of the Federal Equity Assistance Center program and related grants. Another one challenges the Department of Education's decision to no longer collect, maintain, analyze, and disseminate federal education data. A third also challenges the Department of Education's attempts to prohibit and chill efforts to make sure Black students are afforded equal educational opportunities. Three others of these lawsuits deal with cases alleging voter suppression. Another challenges executive orders involving DEI and with the Trump's executive order to eliminate birthright citizenship. That's a lot. But since you come from the world of education, talk about what's happening with the Department of Education and these lawsuits and how what's happening here impacts advances made toward equal educational opportunity over the last 50, 60, 70 years.
It absolutely attacks it. And I think you've enumerated any number of the ways and the strategies. And the truth is, all of which or in part have been outlined in Project 2025, right? A document that was produced by the Heritage Foundation. And it's kind of a playbook. And I think that Trump is pretty much executing it to a T with the elimination of the Department of Education, or in part just by crippling it by, you know, getting rid of staff, you make it dysfunctional. And so even if, you know, on paper, it says it'll still be able to, you know, do some of the things that it's obligated to do, you know, how that will look, I think ultimately in effect will render it ineffective. And I got to be honest here, too. I think that, you know, just calling balls and strikes, I want to pull us away from the focus on the person of Trump, because Trump represents a movement. Project 2025 may be its name, but that was an agenda that's been in place and cooked up for at least the last 70 years. He is merely the spokesperson, merely the mascot of it. And a lot of what we're talking about, the most egregious of it, we can, you know, obviously all agree is reprehensible. But a lot of what this agenda, you know, like, for instance, the, national voucher system, which we're battling here in North Carolina, and part of what is in that big, beautiful air quotes bill. These are things that we haven't seen Democrats come up and stand up against vigorously. And so just to keep in order
well,
to
they
be
all
even
voted against it, every single one
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, this time around. But the truth is, you know, there is no, you know, there is no unified stance from Democrats on, you know, support for public education in the way that we expect it to be. And so a lot of what is the worst of the Trump agenda has either been facilitated by or Democrats have been complicit in either by agreeing or not vigorously defending or pushing back against. And I think that that has to be spoken of in this moment. It would be so easy and so convenient if it was all just reds and blues, good guys and bad guys. But I think it's more complex than that.
They have their ducks in a row, Glenn, from local government all the way up to the White House, because they've been putting this in. They're playing the long game here, and they've been putting these pieces in place for a very long time. And some of these machinations are creating really fierce headwinds, and not just in the civil rights, equal rights arena, but in almost every aspect of our government and how our democracy has traditionally worked. And that's part of this urgency of now theme that the NAACP convention has embraced. But can these moves be adequately impacted by the NAACP and its followers or its legal defense fund or any organization unless they all work together at the same time toward the same ends?
It's an uphill battle, to be sure. I've said this before on your show, Mike, and I think it bears repeating. I think a lot of what we're seeing now goes back to the 2010 election. It was a census year. Democrats didn't show up. 2 years after Barack Obama, they were feeling high. It was a census year. We know what happens in a census year. The maps are redrawn. The maps were gerrymandered, and our country has not recovered from that since. And that is making it very hard for people to have their voices heard right now, whether you are the NAACP or you are a housewife sitting at a kitchen table. Your vote matters a lot less after 2010 than it did before because of the gerrymandering. And politicians are much more likely to ignore the will of voters, making it much harder for voters to have their voices heard, have their power felt. Because as they say, now politicians are picking their voters rather than voters picking their politicians.
Some people may view what's happening at the NAACP and this urgency of now push as something that is different or a backlash to Donald Trump and Project 2025, Mary. But in addition to taking issue with Trump and accusing him of working against, I guess, civil rights, Derek Johnson, who's the president of the organization, has accused him of attacking democracy, saying, quote, he believes more in the fascist playbook than in the U.S. Constitution, a playbook which he calls un-American. And if it is fascist, it certainly is un-American. When an organization like the NAACP says something like that, when they stand up to a government and to government officials who they believe are wrong, can they move the needle? And is this really out of the ordinary? Is this just another step in what they've been doing for 116 years?
Well, you know, there were many times in our history when people felt helpless and hopeless, and they felt nothing could be done. And a lot of people came together, or even in separate small groups, to do something about it. And I think his language is calling the alarm and saying this is one of those times. And you can be complacent and go along with it, or you can do something about it. And knowing that there are forces allied against you, as Glenn alluded to, I saw that the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, is calling them into session, the legislature there, to work on the aftermath of the flood, but also to do some redistricting to make it even more in Republican hands, which some would say that shouldn't be a priority. But as you say, they have all had their ducks in a row. So I do think them calling this out is an alarm. And I think folks should listen to them because, you know, it usually the poor minorities, the disabled, they are the ones that are going to get hit first and hardest. When James was talking about education, many of these things, the Department of Education, that's the reason why people with disabilities and learning disabilities, they have accommodations and they can be a part of society and part of America. So when they talk about hate, Trump is the only one that has used the word hate. So people have to see if they want to do that.
I don't want to run out of time before we talk about this big, beautiful bill, because that's part of the urgency of now, James, that it transcends. It's something that transcends the black community. It's likely to impact everybody, rich and poor, but particularly low income individuals. That bill that just passed, which the NAACP President Derek Johnson and others have warned is a massive transfer of wealth, the largest in U.S. history, to the rich. At the expense of lower income folks, there will be $930 billion in cuts to Medicaid. 600,000 people in North Carolina are likely to be impacted. I have less than a minute. That bill passed. What can be done about it?
I think the most that could be done at this point is for folks to continue to learn more about what all was in the bill, because the impacts of it and when, you know, the destruction of it, I don't think we'll fully know for a very, very long time. And to begin to organize and find ways, once we figure out what's in it, for how to respond. The time is now, we're a little late, but I think the time is now for us to come together and find ways to work on this as a community.
On Tuesday, we're going to have members of the NAACP senior leadership team on this program. They guide the organization's grassroots activism for civil rights and social justice. We'll be discussing those efforts, the strategies the NAACP uses to empower Black communities, and how they can use digital media to amplify advocacy. And you can join us for that conversation on Tuesday at 9. Thanks to Dr. James Ford from Creed, Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro, and Mary C. Curtis from RollCall.com. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.